Yeah, so thank you. It's quite surreal to be back. I was at Warwick 97 to 2002, which is a really long time ago. But yeah, thank you to Keith for the invitation and for coming. So this is quite a patchwork paper in some ways. I think I'll explain about the wolf aspect a bit, but really in the end it's probably more a discussion of the relationship between emotions and politics, and the question of love, hate and fear to some extent, and the way in which the wolf might come to represent or symbolise some of these questions. So there isn't as much on Freud and Deleuze and Guattari as I was originally planning. It became much more about Hobbes and then about that period in philosophical thought. But if people wanted to talk about the Wolfman case, because that's the obvious thing that's going to be missing, as well as Deleuze and Guattari's critique of Freud and the question of the lone wolf and the pack and the question of multiplicity, we can talk about that, because I did reread all those texts but didn't quite manage to get them back into the paper. So that's a possibility. So I'll probably try and speak for about 50 minutes or 55 minutes, see how it goes. So philosophy of the wolf then. The obvious first reference that comes to mind probably for everybody is Hobbes, and the phrase like man is a wolf to man. But I'll come back to that in quite some detail in a minute. But the question of the relationship between philosophy and the animal is obviously quite a key one. There's lots of people doing work on this question of the relationship between thought and animality, or different ways of thinking, the relation between the human and the animal. I mean, it's been going on for quite a long time, and I think there's been a big expansion in this kind of work. I mean, thinking about people like Donna Haraway's recent work, for example, but I mean, animal studies in general is also kind of a big question. I'm not going to talk about that in general, but there is always perhaps in the background the kind of the perhaps a humanist question of the division between the human and the animal. What's the relation between human and the animal? There's also perhaps the major area, the question of the analogy, which is maybe the more political question. Like, what is the wolf analogy doing for Hobbes? If you think back to Aristotle's image of man as a political animal, he refers, of course, to bees and wasps and ants and cranes for some strange reason. But and Aristotle will talk about all of these as being social animals, talks about gregariousness, and that all these animals share one common activity, which is what makes them social for Aristotle. And these groups are with or without a ruler. So cranes and bees have one and ants do not, according to Aristotle. So what Hobbes is partly responding to with the wolf image is this Aristotelian idea of the analogy of particular types of animals and how they might map onto the human social sphere. And in a way, it's a contestation of the Aristotelian image, I think, particularly of the bees, particularly of the hive, but also, and I think more seriously, about the idea of order, perhaps, and a kind of regulation. So the wolf obviously just instinctively perhaps poses questions of wildness, of danger, of threat, of unknown quantities, whether it's a single wolf or the pack of wolves, what lies beyond the city and so on. But it also raises, and I'll come back to this, the question of whether man is indeed constitutively a political animal, is fundamentally political or not. And I think that's also raised by Hobbes. So why the wolf in particular? Well, I mean, partly I just really love wolves, but more broadly, I think there is a question for me, increasingly, of philosophy's own status as a kind of outsider discourse, as a way of thinking and being in the world, which has always been a problem for the social, for the political. I mean, so Diogenes is a particular hero of mine, as a figure who lives sort of in the polis, but is not kind of it. He doesn't retire to the garden. He's not in nature. He's not living in the wilderness. He lives in the city, but he lives off of it whilst kind of attacking it and critiquing it Of course, Diogenes is a cynic, so he's kind of a dog, not a wolf. But actually, if you think about, well, the kind of biological evolution of wolves and dogs, the common dog, we think, had a wolverine ancestor. But actually, you can't turn contemporary wolves into dogs. So we think the wolf ancestor of the common dog doesn't exist, right? So wolves are not trainable, right? The wolves are not domesticated animals. You can't domesticate a wolf, and you can't own a wolf, sadly. I have looked into it. There is quite a funny book called The Philosopher and the Wolf, actually. I can't remember who wrote it, but a guy kind of owns a sort of in some wild part of North America, and he has this, basically, it's like 98% wolf, illegal animal, and he talks about this wolf. And anyway, it's quite a funny book. He's a very unpleasant man, and I wrote a review of it, actually, and I said how unpleasant he was, because he describes himself in this way, and then he sent me an email saying, "You think I'm an unpleasant man?" I said, you said you were in the book. But the serious point I'm maybe making is about this question of the outside and about philosophy, the way in which philosophy is perceived as dangerous often. I mean, think about what happens to Socrates, and Socrates is not nearly as punk as Diogenes in some ways, although he's obviously extremely keen to puncture various kinds of doxological assumption and to, in a way, undermine the kind of, you know, certain bits of Athenian society. So I'm interested in this philosophy as a wolf, right? What is the wolf-like nature of philosophy, whether it's kind of a collective outsiderness or a lone wolf? And when we're thinking about the lone wolf is, I mean, obviously we hear it when it's used in terms of like a terrorist attack, or, a lone wolf is a terrifying figure, right? It's usually a guy who's like a right-wing terrorist or another kind of terrorist, and someone who's alienated, who's completely outside. But in wolf being, the lone wolf is simply a wolf that's travelling from one pack to another, right? So wolves are not sort of inherently lonesome, although we sometimes think they are. And of course, there's a whole dimension of this which is to do with the kind of psychosexual, which, you know, is in Freud's case, but the kind of children's stories of, you know, the Red Riding Hood and the Three Little Pigs and all of this. So I'm not going to get into that aspect of the wolf as this kind of frightening figure, although it is very interesting how the wolf features often, very prominently often, in children's imagination as this frightening outside figure. So this question of the outside then is key, philosophy as outside. I think there's also been a sort of growing interest in the question of the wild within thought. So figures like Jack Halberstam have been talking about rewilding and this idea of the outside. A place where, as Halberstam puts it, temporality is uncertain, relation is improvised, and futurity is on hold. And this idea about the future being on hold is very interesting, because when Hobbes in Leviathan talks about the state of nature, there's no time in the state of nature, he says. Like, time is not possible. All the other things aren't possible either, industry and culture. But I find this particular observation very interesting, what it means to live without time in the state of nature. Is nature kind of then atemporal in some way? And then what is our relation to that? So wildness and the wolf is a kind of threat to politics, we might say, and to the social, or even to ourselves as individuals. But it is also central to it, and to try to understand what the wildness is, the animality of man and the animality in the political. To ourselves, the wildness in ourselves and in the other, and in more kind of intimate realms, the kind of complexity and the violence of passion in emotions. And that's kind of what the second part will be about, love and hate, and how these feature politically, possibly. For Alain Sixou, who wrote a very beautiful essay called Love of the Wolf in 94, which I recently came across, she kind of puts this question like this. She says, when there is a danger from outside, you bolt. But when the danger comes from inside, how can you bolt? The danger from inside is that complicated thing, the love of the wolf, the complicity that attaches us to that which threatens us. So I think this question of the inside and the outside, of course, is obviously dialectical. Sorry to use that word when Stephen's here. But I'm using it in a sort of budget way. But that question of the inside and the outside, you know, the animal is us, right? It's not, you know, and I think that idea that we can simply say, no, the wolf is always elsewhere, isn't correct. And in a way that our attraction to the wolf or to the wild is always present, it's always a temptation to rewild oneself, perhaps. Okay, so to talk about Hobbes for a bit. So the famous quote from Hobbes that everybody knows is actually in On the Citizen, which is published in Latin in 16... he wrote it in 1641, it was published in 1647. So before Leviathan, and he tries out some of the ideas in Leviathan, which he'll go into in more detail in this text, On the Citizen. And the quote actually comes from... the first part, which is the epistle dedicated to the Earl of Devonshire, who's of the family that Hobbes works for a lot of his life. And Hobbes is discussing Rome, whose symbol is, of course, the wolf, the she-wolf, with the twins, as the founding myth. And again, moving away from this idea of like the Greek origin of politics, so away from Aristotle, more towards Rome. And in this kind of dedication... he talks about the possibility of kings being predatory animals, so the possibility of the tyrant, which he's keen to avoid, as well as the threat of wolves, plural, threatening freedom as they lurk in the forest. And wolves there perhaps is talking about bandits, so the kind of the insecurity of the city, like Rome is under siege, like what is Rome being attacked by? So this is what Hobbes actually says. So we usually have the quote taken out of context, like homo homine lupus est, right? So we know that quote. But this is the full quote in English. He says, there are two maxims which are surely both true. Man is a god to man, and man is a wolf to man. So that's the full quote. He continues, the former is true of the relations of citizens with each other. So that's the man is a god to man. The latter of relations between commonwealths, so man is a wolf to man, is actually a collective relation, so the relation of the collective to other collectives. So he continues, in justice and charity, the virtues of peace, citizens show some likeness to God, but between commonwealths, the wickedness of bad men compels the good to have recourse for their own protection to the virtues of war, which are violence and fraud, he says, i.e. to the predatory nature of beasts. Okay, so the wolf is always a possibility then of the state to behave like wolves. So not only are there the bandits threatening, there's not only the animality of man himself, which I think is probably the usual way people might understand homo homine lupus est, which is to say the idea that in the state of nature that one would revert or behave in a certain animal way. And that's, I think, almost as individuals, like that the wolf is an individual possibility. But that's not what Hobbes actually says in the introduction to On the Citizen. He continues to discuss what he calls the wolf-like element which men deplore in each other. And in that sense, he's talking about the idea of a kind of projection. We project onto the other a certain suspiciousness. And there's a sense in which Hobbes is making a kind of epistemic point about a certain scepticism that we might have to the motives of the other, right? So we always suspect the other of potentially being wolf-like to us, and we're less likely to think of ourselves as being potentially wolf-like. I'll come back to this. So there's also an idea of projection there in Hobbes about where the wolf is. In a later text, De Homine from 1658, he's actually kinder to wolves. He's much more reasonable towards them. And he's less kind to humans. And this is the quote from the 1658 text. He says, man surpasseth in rapacity and cruelty the wolves, bears and snakes, that are not rapacious and less hungry and not cruel and less provoked. So the animals are not inherently cruel. They're not cruel for no reason. They don't induce excessive suffering. Whereas man, he says, is famished even by future hunger. So that calculative dimension of humanity is actually what places it beyond a possible, sort of wolf-like cruelty. The wolf is not inherently cruel, and indeed, realistically, actual wolves are not inherently cruel at all. People might be afraid of them, but the fear is often far disproportionate to how wolves actually behave. Wolves are generally quite timid, and they don't interact with humans very often. Okay, so man then is possibly worse than wolves because of this futural dimension. Okay, so there's a very interesting reading of Hobbes on wolves by Diego Rosello, who did some very fantastic work on melancholy and animality in Hobbes and modern sovereignty. And he suggests that Hobbes, in indicating the possibility of the wolf in man, is perhaps referring, in fact, to lycanthropy, so the idea of man becoming turning into a wolf, a werewolf, which was a very deep fear at this time in the middle of the 17th century. And obviously, in Leviathan, Hobbes is trying to counteract an awful lot of superstitious ideas. He talks a lot about ghosts and how we must kind of get away from being seduced by or manipulated by those who talk about such things. And then there's this kind of attempt by Rosello to almost historicize why Hobbes picks the wolf, why the wolf and not another dangerous animal. And this idea of lycanthropy then, as a kind of melancholic syndrome, the idea of turning into an animal, becoming possessed by sort of animal spirits, if you like, and creating this kind of very fearful combined figure of the man and the wolf, right? So the wolf is not a separate being, the wolf is a possibility of man in that sense. And that Hobbes's political project for Rosello is a kind of therapeutic one, in that Hobbes is trying to explain how we can leave behind animality through securing the artificial commonwealth. And of course, in a way, Hobbes, in his anti-Aristotelian move, isn't saying we're naturally political. He's saying, look, we have to create this artificial commonwealth. You know, that's the kind of point of it. But Rosello suggests it's to avoid these melancholic potentials, the idea that one can become deranged through emotion. So lycanthropy comes to stand in there for all kinds of negative passions that then infect the political sphere. And I think we could probably think today about what are the dominant negative passions. I think there's a lot of anxiety, there is a lot of depression, there's a lot of division in the political, any political discussion, particularly maybe in Britain in the last few years. And that kind of question about what threatens the social bond, or what you need to address therapeutically in order for the social to hold together, is quite an interesting one. During the English Civil War, there were indeed some discussions about wolves and the wolf-like nature of man. So James Howell, who's a kind of historian, describes what he calls the desperate case of his nation, as in Britain, who seemed to have fallen quite from the very faculty of reason and to be possessed with a pure lycanthropy, with a wolfish kind of manner to tear one another in this way. They err, he says, who write that there are no wolves in England. Okay, so England then becomes this, like, wolfish battle. Here men are all turned into wolves, he says. And this is in the middle of the 17th century. So Hobbes' project then can be seen perhaps as a way of curbing the wolfish humours that are always possible, rather than the thinking of the wolf as primarily outside or on the edges. And Hobbes at the time obviously upsets loads of people by comparing men to wolves, right? Because it's very animalistic, materialist, sort of anti-Christian. It removes men. I mean, even though Hobbes makes that point about man can be a god to man, to say that man is also a wolf to man is in a way to kind of maybe eliminate some dignity from man. But I think it's obviously a much more realistic way of thinking to address, if you like, the darker possibilities that everybody has, everyone is capable of feeling. And so Rosello then ultimately thinks that Hobbes's project is therapeutic to remedy the melancholy which leads to political unrest. So not just from outside the different commonwealths, but also within the state. And obviously that we have the animalistic descriptions and the other famous quotes from Hobbes in the brutish and savage sort of state of nature, that kind of image of the animal there. So Rosello ultimately proposes, and I think I agree, that Hobbes's politics comprises three main claims. One, that humans are animals. I think we're more or less okay with this claim if we're reading Nietzsche in particular, of the idea of the human animal. But at the time, I mean, it's quite controversial. Hobbes ends up having to be protected by some of his friends from the kind of some of the implications of Leviathan and its materialism. So one, human are animals. Two, humans are not political inherently. But three, that human animals can be political, so they're not ontologically political, but they are ontologically animals. And the way they can be political is by the use of words, which is to say that being human is a process, a precarious, unstable result of humanization, and this is the role of the contract in Hobbes. So obviously the ascent in Leviathan will become this, hypothetical sort of declaration that one is committed contractually. Obviously, we're talking about contract theory. So then we have this image of like a kind of wolfish howling, this kind of like a signifying noise that becomes then human discourse, that becomes comprehensible language. So we are not born suited to society, but rather we can enter into this. And I wonder if this is actually very important today for thinking about questions of atomization, of alienation, to actually think from Hobbes's starting point rather than Aristotle's, or rather than thinking that we're inherently sociable or social, but rather thinking that we are not necessarily so. Because I think the experience of contemporary life for many people is primarily one of a feeling of alienation or isolation. And we can see this in precisely the discussions of the lone wolf, for example, which come back in political discourse and discussions around the incel and, you know, the supposedly disaffected, usually male, almost always male figure subject. So I think this is one thing I want to say, is that actually Hobbes maybe has a more realistic starting point, because it's not an inclusive one straightforwardly. That society is a process, a precarious process that's always threatening to fall apart back into kind of a-signifying howling. So we are wolves then, packs or solitary. And this, as I said, is a kind of epistemic claim, a kind of sceptical attitude to sociability. And I was going to sort of link it a little bit to maybe what Kant says about unsocial sociability, but I think there's a bit more work that needs to be done there, but we can talk about it. And the actual original quote where Hobbes takes this from is from Plautus, who's a sort of Roman comedic writer. And the original wolf quote is, "Man is a wolf and not a man to the one who knows nothing of his character." So this makes more sense as well of the scepticism that Hobbes is potentially pursuing. So man is a wolf to the one who knows nothing of his character, which is to say there's a necessary suspicion in social life. We shouldn't necessarily trust the other, you know, then this seems to be Hobbes's implication. So the question of fear, whether it's legitimate or not. Men are not naturally brothers then, but this is something that has to kind of be bonded in the Commonwealth, right? The Commonwealth is the ascent to a certain brotherhood or, you know, a relation. It's important to note, however, that wolves do not eat each other. Right? I'm just going to leave that there. Okay, so to bring it back, well, bring it forward, I don't know where I'm going with this. Moving on to this question then of violence. So I've become increasingly interested in how societies prevent violence. It's an extremely Hobbesian question. Obviously, Hobbes is right in the middle of the Civil War. We're not in a civil war. Civil war is another word for stasis. Stasis is always potentially violent. I did lots of work on public order a few years ago, and the assumption of every sovereign state, including England and Wales, is that public disorder is the reality, and that order is thinly imposed. actually, we don't live in a state of order, and the sovereign, the state, certainly doesn't see it like that. Order is something that has to be maintained and preserved, the Queen's peace, in this country, at all costs, basically. So there's a fundamental anarchy, potentially, that's always there, and that's more fundamental, perhaps, than order, would be the point. So then this kind of question about how societies prevent violence from breaking out, and I don't always just mean violence in the form of physical interaction, but rather other forms of kind of vicious opposition, instead of, let's say, the kind of dialogue or discussion and so on. So René Girard, who's a very, very interesting kind of Catholic anthropologist, some of you probably read, in Violence and the Sacred, says the following: the mechanism of reciprocal violence can be described as a vicious circle. Once a community enters the circle, it is unable to extricate itself. We can define this circle in terms of vengeance and reprisals, and we can offer diverse psychological descriptions of these reactions. As long as a working capital of accumulated hatred and suspicion exists at the centre of the community, it will continue to increase no matter what men do. Each person prepares himself for the probable aggression of his neighbours and interprets his neighbours' preparations as confirmation of the latter's aggressiveness. In more general terms, the mimetic character of violence is so intense that once violence is installed in a community, it cannot burn itself out. And this very pessimistic image of how communities end up in spirals of violence. And the question then becomes how we avoid that. So in relation to Hobbes, this epistemic scepticism about whether you can trust the other, I think, becomes very key, because that if you take it too far, the fear of the other becomes hatred of the other, and there's no kind of point of comparison. Whereas actually, I think what Hobbes says in Leviathan is actually about how similar we are, and that actually recognising our similarities is, in a sense, the kind of precondition for understanding how politics works. Girard does make this point too in the question of mimetic rivalry, which is to say we copy each other because we want the same things, and that human beings are fundamentally and profoundly copying beings, as it were. We mirror each other, we emulate each other. And if we want things that are desirable, let's say whatever is valued in a society, it could be, I don't know, beauty, it could be money, whatever. If we think we want the same thing, we will copy each other, but we will also become extremely rivalrous. And this is very similar to what Hobbes says in Leviathan, where he talks about nature hath made men so equal in the faculties of body and mind, as that though there be found one man sometimes manifestly stronger in body or of quicker mind than another, yet when all is reckoned together, the difference between man and man is not so considerable as that one man can thereupon claim to himself any benefit to which another may not pretend as well as he. So actually, rivalry and violence stems from similarity and sameness, not from difference, because it's sameness that comes first. The question of then our nature, our human nature, and our relation to the animal, or our human animality, then generates for Hobbes, as he says, competition, diffidence, and glory, which are the three main causes of antagonism or quarrel. And Hobbes's attempt is to try and understand these drives and desires and to imagine a way of preventing excessive antagonism, the time of war. And politics, or a common power, is thus the comprehension of emotion in the attempt to generate peace to allow for industry, culture, knowledge and history itself, as well as time. And I think one thing that's maybe kind of not happening that much in contemporary discussions of politics is this understanding of what we have in common that is actually generating a lot of friction and antagonism. And this really is then the question of emotion and politics, which for the philosophers such as Hobbes, but also of Spinoza in particular, and Spinoza obviously in the Ethics, says that emotions are no different in principle to geometrical objects or ideas, which is to say we can completely rationally map the emotions. I mean, that's what the Ethics is really about. It's like saying they're not. It's not this mysterious, murky continent. Even though we might feel it like that, or we might think of emotions as occult, bizarre things that we can't possibly deal with. Spinoza says completely, you know, opposite to that. He says that they hatred, anger, envy follow from the same necessity and force of nature as all other particular things. So these emotions are assignable to definite causes through which they can be understood and have definite properties, and are equally open to investigation, which is also what Freud will say later in Instincts and Their Vicissitudes. He says, look, we can absolutely understand these phenomena. Indeed, we should. And Spinoza has this wonderful line, I shall consider human actions and appetites just as if it were an investigation into lines, planes, or bodies, right? So that kind of absolute mappability of emotion. So the question of the same, the question of the sort of rational mapping of emotion leads us back, as with Hobbes always, to the question of nature, of human nature. And I think perhaps the polemical point of my part of what I want to say here is that we are being there's a lot of wariness about talking about human nature or talking about nature in relation to the human today, whether it be this question of animality, even though people are working on the animal and the human a lot. I think this question of human nature has become absolutely profoundly off limits for a lot of thinkers, or they're very opposed to this discussion. I think to speak of human nature today is often to be accused of being on the side of essentialism, which is one of the worst possible crimes one can commit. So those who invoke nature or human nature are often perceived as naive pre-moderns, incapable of understanding the transformations made to and by humanity, by civilization, or worse, they're conservatives of one type or another, crypto-conservatives. They might be religiously or scientifically motivated, but invariably the enemy of progressive politics. So this question of human nature becomes deeply political all the way down. The idea that everything is social before it is natural has come to kind of dominate a lot of discourse. And even when there is a residual commitment to the comprehension of matter in a materialist way, there is often also a kind of Promethean desire to transcend this, as in, for example, in the left accelerationist slogan, this one from the Xenofeminist Manifesto, if nature is unjust, change nature. And I think this attempt to politicise nature this way round, right, which is to say from the standpoint of the social, from the technological, from the futuristic, from the speculative, is foolish, is foolhardy. I think, you know, for all of these philosophers, you know, from Hobbes and Spinoza, and I'll maybe mention Giordano Bruno and others, you know, you cannot understand anything about politics unless you understand human nature. And the first book of Leviathan is about man. It's not about politics. Basically, Hobbes is saying you have to understand man before you can talk about what politics is. And I think there's a kind of rush to say, well, nature is always on the side of injustice. It's always hierarchical. It's always unfair. Things like desire are profoundly unfair. And in practice, they are, right? Because some people are much more desirable than others. This is also Girard's point about rivalry. Some people are not going to get what they want. And that nature itself is very brutal. Like, you know, I grew up in the countryside. It is very brutal. You see lots of dead things. It's, you know, it's a violent and wild thing. And, of course, when Freud and others talk about civilization and, you know, in Civilization and Its Discontents, which is a kind of reworking of Nietzsche's genealogy in lots of ways, you know, Freud and others don't deny that there are instincts and that there are the nature. And I think sometimes we're in danger of simply saying there's no nature, there's only construction, or there's only our desire to make things new and different. So if nature isn't fair, and if this is what we observe and react to in the first place politically, then we will find ourselves railing against something we've already decided we understand and felt that we did not like. So what is this changed nature that the xenofeminist and sort of left accelerationist position is kind of opposing? What weapons would we wield against a nature that we felt was fundamentally unfair? What comes to mind, of course, is technology in the first place, of kind of interventions at the level of the material, chemical, physical. And we could say that these two are a consequence of our own human nature, right? The idea that, you know, technology is some alien force, of course it's not. It's a human capacity. It's something that belongs to us as well. Human beings are the kinds of beings who naturally create the kinds of tools that can create nature. Where we draw the line then between the natural and the artificial, or the human and the post-human, then is obviously a matter of great discussion. So even the most advanced technology from this perspective is a product, a natural product of our own human nature, would be the argument. And so everywhere there is this attempt to draw the line between what we can say is natural and what is not. And I'm not denying that there are problems with saying something is natural, therefore this is how things are. I mean, clearly there are kind of issues, to do with essential claims that are very, very complicated. But I think the rush to deny or to refuse certain questions about how human beings behave and continue to behave in ways that are very old, actually, that aren't new, and that we can't easily overcome simply by having a technocratic society, for example, or by changing our nature, remain. And I think it's very dangerous to say that we can't talk about human nature. In a way, they're trying to keep the wolf from the door, but I would invite the wolf in. So this question then of the human, the animal, but also the human and the trans or the post or the non-human, how we feel about nature, how we should feel about technology, about these deep emotions such as love and hate, which are also subject, of course, to technological manipulation, chemical manipulation in particular. How much of modernity and contemporary life then is spent pretending that civilization has tipped us beyond these deeper currents, the ones that Hobbes and others identify. And so in that sense, I think philosophy is on the side of the wolf, which is to say to try and recognise these often very painful and difficult feelings that we're all capable of feeling. And Freud attempts to do this too much later. When he talks about love and hate, he talks about the ambivalence of love. We tend to think of it as a pure emotion, but of course it's a very mixed emotion. And he says that hate is older than love in this essay from 1915, because in a way it's the first kind of ego relation that we have to objects. It's like we want to get rid of things, we want to push things away. And love, of course, can transform very easily into hate, as, for example, if somebody we love breaks off a relation with us, we then might flip into hate. Nevertheless, I would say our contemporary understanding of hate is extremely confused. I don't think people have a very good handle on what it is. And one of the problems I think that's happening at the moment is the idea that there is another who hates. It's always the other who hates, right? There is a group of people or a person who is imagined to suffer and feel these feelings that we ourselves pretend or we think we don't feel. And I think this kind of othering is very dangerous, and it's very paradoxical, because of course we would want to say, you know, other people are dangerous, there are dangerous ideas, there are dangerous forms of behaviour, but the kind of the question of the solution, I think we can't understand why people might think things that are different from us if we don't also think that we are capable and we ourselves feel negative things. So there's a kind of clean hands, beautiful soul problem that I think is going on a lot in politics. And if you say, well, look, they're the other who hates, then in a way you're saying that anything can happen to them. Like, you know, we can do anything to them because they are filled with hate. And this is very dangerous, I think. So just a little bit about Giordano Bruno, who's a kind of quite peripheral and very interesting figure in the history of thought, philosophy and religion, and also magic as well. I mean, if you go to Rome in Campo di Fiore, there's a very beautiful statue of Bruno. He was burnt alive for his various heresies, and he did a kind of amusing job of defending himself, in which he sort of answered all of his critics by kind of restating his own beliefs and pretending he was saying sorry, but he wasn't actually. He was kind of unrepentant, and he talked, amongst other things, about how the universe was infinite, which went against kind of Catholic thinking at the time. He's a very interesting character. But the thing I just want to pick out from Bruno, from 1588, so before Hobbes, almost a century before, is this question of the erotic character of love and hate, and the question of eros and politics. And we can think about it in terms of libido or will or something like this. Obviously, for Freud, both love and hate retain their erotic character. They're never not erotic in a certain way. But how then do we link this kind of eros, these feelings, back to politics? Bruno, in his general account of bonding from 1588, outlines the need for what he calls a universal theory of things that involves an examination of civil life along the lines of bonds and knots. So what ties us, if you like, to each other, whether it be to our friends or to our family or to society. So Bruno's conception of bonding is quite difficult on the surface to understand, because it conjures up slightly strange and magical and even proto-psychoanalytic or psychological images of metaphorical ties, ribbons and invisible chains. He talks a lot about the vinculum and the idea of a kind of bond, which also reminds us perhaps of Lacan and the obsession with knots. Also R.D. Lang will talk about knots as a way of thinking about how we are in very different relations, but these bonds and these knots. It's very useful to remember that religion, the word itself, stems etymologically, at least in some interpretations, from the Latin word religare, which is to bind fast. Yoga actually also means binding, it's a yoke it means, which indicates that Bruno is concerned with spiritual bonds, the bonds between man and God, between men and women, not to mention animals as well, and other non-human beings. He lists as universal bonding agents God, demons, souls, animals, nature, chance, luck, and fate. So it's a very strange territory, kind of like an occult theory of politics in some ways. He says humans are bound in many ways, and the same thing can bond opposing and contradictory things. For example, the bonds of physical love, which he says seem to be both a fire and a snare at the same time, which drive one to shout and to be silent, to joy and to sorrow, to hope and desperation, to fear and to boldness, to anger and to gentleness, to weeping and to laughter. In relation to what we would today call politics, we can pay attention to what Cugliano, who wrote an excellent book called Eros and Magic in the Renaissance, describes as the fundamental presupposition of Bruno's erotic magic, is that a large tool for manipulation exists, which is eros, in the most general sense of the word, that which we love, from physical pleasure to things probably unsuspected in passing by wealth, power, etc. Everything for Bruno is defined in relation to eros, since aversion and hatred merely represent the negative side of the same universal attraction. So this kind of erotic theory of politics then alerts us, I think, in the word manipulation, as Hobbes is trying to do in Leviathan as well, to the way in which we are being played constantly or potentially open to being played at these very deep levels, almost and often behind our backs. So politics and the social becomes a game of love, and the manipulation of love and of hate. We could say all negative emotions. And that's also then back to the problem of lycanthropy and how certain negative emotions can be manipulated or might threaten the social bond. And there's a kind of perhaps a question of a broken fellow feeling that might be understood when we're thinking about atomization. Also just in terms of kind of a daily experience of politics, which often involves feelings of great anger, sadness, hate. If you think about, I don't know, social media as an outlet for being angry about, you know, particular political situations. And I'm not suggesting that there's no reason to be angry. There's many reasons to be angry about, you know, unfairness and injustice and other things. But that kind of deeper question about how emotions are being played. I'm obsessed with like Trump's use of exclamation marks, for example, as a form of magical manipulation. Like, what does Trump's exclamation mark actually like induce in the the readers of his tweets? So as I've said, really, this kind of question then becomes this sort of subject supposed to hate in a way, like the other who feels emotion that we ourselves think that we do not feel, that we're somehow more rational than the other. Because everybody wants to be a good person, right? Nobody wants to be the wolf. Nobody wants to be, if you like, the person who is dangerous. But to say that we love and it is the other who hates doesn't help, not least because love itself is ambivalent. Love itself is, not a pure emotion. To say that people are stupid or deplorable, as often a lot of political discourse does, Hillary Clinton famously said that, described people in the Midwest as deplorables, very stupid thing to do if you're trying to get elected. That level of sort of disrespect for the working class is a kind of classic political move, but a very, very negative one. And I think, so I suppose maybe just to kind of wrap up a little bit, is to say, on the one hand, I want to say that, like, philosophy should retain something of its wolf-like status itself, that it should be outside of doxa, that it shouldn't be hidebound by any kind of ideology in a certain way, as difficult as that is. So it needs to retain sort of like its Diogenes-esque mode of critique, which is to say to oppose the existing order in whatever way, humorously, amongst other things, to poke holes in it. And Diogenes does all manner of silly and amusing things, like walking backwards through crowds and, eating scraps and, playing off of status things. So one of the famous things he does is, like, he doesn't have any property, he lives in the water cistern, usually described as a barrel, and he has a cup, which is his only possession, and then he sees a beautiful youth drinking water with his hands from the stream and dodge, and he looks at his cup and goes, "I don't need this," and, like, smashes the cup. So playing with the kind of the nothing, what it means to, like, have nothing and to be nothing, actually, to be kind of, like, without identity, but with a kind of, like, critical and antagonistic relation. So there is kind of the idea of, like, philosophy as the wolf, as maybe the emblem of a certain kind of philosophy, but that is also prepared to, like, take risks, let's say, and to be excluded and to be feared. That philosophy shouldn't become like a lapdog, it shouldn't be like a loyal servant or a, nothing against dogs, like, dogs are wonderful, but, that there is the difference between the wolf and the dog, which is they can't breed out. It's a deep ontological difference between the wolf and the dog. So I think Diogenes probably should have been hanging around with dogs in the city, with wolves rather than dogs, but anyway, the dogs are probably pretty wild. So I think against the enemies of philosophy, then, the wolf insists that one should know one's own mind. And in fact, Hobbes is kind of perhaps pessimistic or sceptical starting point is actually far more realistic recognition of the very, manipulable and mixed set of emotions that we all have, and all of our fears and our doubts and so on, which we experience both individually and collectively, and that kind of both desire for the wild and our ambivalence towards the social, and the fragility then of the social, that we're not kind of constitutively political animals in any kind of comforting way, that we're kind of torn all the time between these sorts of ideas of civilization and these ideas of the outside and of nature. But nevertheless, in a way, Hobbes's positive conclusion is that, well, if we recognise these things, as Spinoza is saying also, like, that we can rationally map emotions, we can understand the cause of negative passions, sad passions, for example. So if we end up doing something repeatedly, which is bad for us, if we work out what it is that's, like, causing the pain, we can stop doing it. And that would go for addiction, to being in love with the same kind of wrong person endlessly or whatever. I mean, there's a way of, it's a, like, practical philosophy as well. So there is hope in mapping these things and understanding these negative emotions also in Freud. And it's too easy to say they simply belong to the other, and it becomes very dangerous. We start treating people that we think are too outside in a very, very alienating way. We make them more outside. And I suppose this is one of the problems where we feel so divided from each other and we don't think there's anything that we can talk about. Whereas for Hobbes, it's precisely the speech, the idea that we can talk, that permits a fragile social peace. It's in fact the only thing we can do. But again, it's not coming from a nice starting point of dialogic reason in which, oh, how wonderful, we're all, capable of talking. It's starting from a very, very much darker point, which is to say, we're basically all howling most of the time, and it's only in brief moments that we can come together and talk about things. So I think the sort of wolf philosophy then recognises those tendencies in ourselves, all of us, and then, has difficult conversations, I suppose. And that's what I want philosophy to sort of defend and not shut down, those forms of, addressing these kind of darker aspects of all of us. So, I'll leave it there for now.